Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Well, good Friday afternoon. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Rathmanner. Wonderful to have you here this afternoon. We're going to have a great conversation with author Paul Miller today about love. Great thing to talk about as we head into this weekend. And let me ask you this question. Have you ever struggled to love? Maybe you've struggled to love someone in your family who just seems to be unlovable. Or perhaps you've loved yet received no love in return. Or maybe you just struggle to love when it seems as if no one is noticing or no one cares. Well, amidst broken relationships and rejection and hurt, how do we keep reaching out to others and loving others despite getting nothing in return? Well, that's some of what we're going to talk about today. On today's show, we have author Paul Miller. He joins me today to talk about his book, A Loving Life in a World of Broken Relationships. Paul Miller is executive director of See Jesus, which is a ministry that creates and conducts interactive discipleship seminars throughout the world, as well as the best-selling author of A Praying Life, among other works that he's done. He and his wife Jill live in the Philadelphia area, and they have six children and a growing number of grandchildren, it says Paul. Does there seem to be one popping up every once in a while?
Yes, every once in a while. We are up to 10 by God's grace.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that sounds very busy and very fun.
Yes, we got a head start because my wife and I were married when we were 18 and 19. So we, and I'm 16 now, so we had a lot of time.
Wow, yes, that's amazing. I just keep telling my kids, you better have your kids early because I want to be alive when they are born. We have the opposite. We had the opposite experience with ours. Well, enough about me. I want to know more about you. So your book, A Praying Life, came out 5 years ago, received just so much praise for just teaching us how to connect with God. And now you've written this new book called A Loving Life. What led you to come to this subject next?
Well, the impetus, I guess a couple things. One was just the impetus was we lost a grandson. One of our daughter-in-laws was eight months pregnant, and she had preeclampsia, and the baby died. And so I wanted to give a gift to my son and daughter-in-law, and the Book of Ruth, which deals so much with suffering, which just seems like such a great gift. So I wrote a Bible study on it, and then I turned that Bible study into a book. But the other thing was just that God had taken me through many of those experiences, and I'd read the book once a year, and it always my soul vibrated to the book is probably the simplest way to say it.
Well, and you mentioned that relationship of you. One between you and your daughter-in-law, I'm sure your wife and your daughter-in-law. I mean, this A Loving Life book is presented with the Book of Ruth, the wonderful story between a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law and how love is depicted there. So why that relationship? Why was that the one that led you to say, hey, this is a true book about love and about God's love for us as well?
Well, it was just experiences. Probably the unifying idea of the Book of Ruth is the Hebrew idea of love, which you don't hear too much. I mean, you hear a lot about agape, but I love the Hebrew idea of love, which is sort of the central theme of the book, which is the word hesed. And you're actually supposed to cough when you say the H for hesed and say hesed, but that's all right. Or it's a kind of a, it's down in your throat. But we'll just use hesed love. And what it is, it's a word that combines two ideas, the idea of love and the idea of commitment. So it's translated a lot of different ways in different translations, but the idea of it is covenant love or committed love would be, you know, one way. And that was what drew me, was just having been in situations like that where God called me to committed love. I think of it as love without an exit strategy, which we in our modern world, we're willing to love just so I have an escape hatch. So that's what drew me to the book.
It does seem like our idea of love in our culture today, not only does it have an escape hatch, but it's based on feelings. If I don't feel like I'm in love, well, I can just leave. And if I don't feel like I want to be here at this point in time, there's nothing that's going to keep me there. So how does that Hesed love differ? And in school, they told me if I don't spit on the person sitting in front of me, I'm not doing it right. So, yes, the Hesed love, how does that differ from the way we seem to look at love in our society today?
Yeah. And again, there is nothing wrong with feelings in love. And I would just say what obviously you're poking at, Joe, is that there are many feelings in love. And what people do, though, is they hunt for a warm, fuzzy feeling in love. And that does come often. You often experience that depending on what the love relationship is. And that's not a bad thing, so I don't want to denigrate that. But what people tend to do is they hunt for almost an ecstatic state. And because that's something that particularly in a marriage relationship, they felt that at the beginning. So they end up almost making that a chase. And when they're hunting for that state, they're really on a quest for intimacy. But intimacy is a byproduct of love. And if you go at it directly, you almost always lose it. And the idea of a commitment is that I set my heart to love this person no matter what. And it's very freeing, because if the other person doesn't love me or treats me poorly, I can still choose to love them. I have to adjust that and love them in different ways. But it keeps me from the tyranny of all of being almost captured by my feelings. That if for some reason there is no feeling in this relationship that I'm feeling good about, that I don't have to exit it, that I can endure in love, even if I don't feel like it. And that, you know, for a lot of Americans, that's like a really radical idea.
Right. And it's almost like, I mean, you mentioned in your book that this kind of love actually is narrowing, and that's a good thing.
Yes. It is an example from the book of Ruth is Ruth, when she commits to Naomi, she narrows her life. And what happens with people is when you get into a relationship, say a marriage or whatever, that you immediately, but particularly I think it's true in marriage, although the book isn't just a marriage book, it's really a book on how to love in every relationship. But what you begin to almost immediately feel is a constriction going on. And people react to that constriction thinking something's wrong, but that's actually the nature of love. So if you know that, it doesn't sort of freak you out. I mean, and you can think of 1,000 examples of that, but, you know, if I love... if I'm dating and then I start and then I become engaged to that person, immediately you're constricted because you're no longer dating multiple people. And so there's now one woman or one man in your life, and that there's wonderful things about that constriction, but it is a constriction, and it's in the very nature of love to constrict. And to flip from, marriage to Bethlehem to Christmas, that as God loves us, he's constricted. So he becomes a little baby boy. And, you know, let's make up some numbers, but it would have been something like a 6-pound little Jewish boy in the year, give or take a couple of years, around 5 BC, and in a cave in Bethlehem with a Jewish woman named Mary. I mean, it's really specific, you know. So he doesn't sort of float above life. And part of us, and it's actually why a lot of guys are fearful of pursuing marriage is our modern world so prizes freedom that it's kind of worship freedom. So, and that's why they that people haven't really connected dots, but they're actually fearful of the constriction that goes with love, and the result is they never grow up. That was a mouthful, Joe. I don't know. I said a lot. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense. That love, well, felt to be like it's constricting in a bad way, that the constriction actually offers us a lot more freedom because we are no longer distracted by our feelings of what love is. We are instead directed by the commitment that we've made to love.
Yes, and in that constriction, that's where we mature. You know, that's when you become, you really come to Christian maturity in the constriction. And we think that maturity is creating a lot of feel-good experiences or something like that. You'd think that if you only watch TV, you know, or just movies or something like that, it sort of absorbed our culture. Because the worst thing that our culture says is you want to preserve your freedom. And if you get stuck in a relationship where you're losing your freedom, then you're going to destroy yourself and you're on a bad trajectory. Well, in fact, that's the trajectory that produces maturity. Mm.
It's almost like when people say, I don't know that I'm ready to have kids. And I kind of laugh in the back of my head and say, oh, honey, you're never ready to have kids.
Right.
But what it does,
no one's ready.
But what it does is it does cause you to focus in on this most amazing experience to the exclusion of some other experiences. But it's in that you find you find what it truly means to be a parent that you would never know unless you went head first, 100% into that role.
Yes. Yes. Our fifth child has just had their first baby, and now they're really at the state of what was it like? They're losing touch. It's only been 4 months now, but they're sort of losing touch with their pre-baby self. You know? And because you really learn how to love first in marriage, and then in having children. Again, if that's not the state that God's called you to, I don't mean to say at all that that's the only way you can learn how to love, but it's a particularly important one for our culture to learn the value of it. And let me just address a whole other area of single women related to that, whether because of the dearth of Christian men to marry, that there are a lot of just lovely young women in their 30s and 40s or late 20s, they're beginning a sort of a low-level panic, that there are a lot of single women who don't have any prospects. And that's a different kind of constriction. But it is a constriction, nevertheless. You can learn how to love, because your danger in that constriction is to recoil from it and become bitter in some way, as to understanding that the journey of love always involves that there's this kind of fellowship of sharing in his suffering in the very activity of love.
You know, one of the concepts I loved reading about in your book was that shape of the journey. We're going to talk about that just on the other side of the break. We're going to take a quick break, and we're also going to try to reconnect with Paul, see if we can get a clearer signal there from him, so you can really hear the depth of everything that he's saying. And if you're listening along and you say, boy, that book sounds really interesting, I'd love to learn more about living in a loving life, we'd love for you to give us a call at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. We have a few copies to give away. And also, if you have a question about love, or you've just heard something that kind of spurs a story you'd like to tell or an experience you'd like to share, we'd love to have you join us on the air. 877-933-2484. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith.
I
talking about love today with author Paul Miller. He's best-selling author of A Praying Life, also the executive director of See Jesus, which is a ministry creating and conducting interactive discipleship seminars throughout the world. He's written a new book called A Loving Life in a World of Broken Relationships. And Paul, we were talking before the break just about the shape of love, the shape that love is a journey, and it's not something that that just goes up. That there might be a little bit of down and then up. In fact, I think you compared it to Disney movies. How so?
Right. I mean, not only is love not in a static state, it's a journey. And then there's a shape to the journey, just as you said, and it's shaped like the letter J. And it's shaped like the letter J goes down and then up. And it's just and the reason for I use the letter J is it's very distinctive, but it's the pattern of the gospel that Jesus is his life, his descent downward into death at the very bottom and then upwards into resurrection. That is the normal, according to Apostle Paul, like in Philippians 3, verse 10, that's the normal Christian life. And what we want is this sort of this, escalating, line that goes straight up, from victory to victory. But that the gospel, as it works in our lives, just doesn't work that way. And it's the pattern of almost every Old Testament story, and Disney's genius is that he uses that, Disney uses that in their, every one of their cartoons has a Disney shape to it. And my six-year-old daughter many years ago said, "Oh, the stories are happy, sad, happy."
Hmm.
And that we want to go happy, happy, happier or some kind of version like that. And it's just it's just God draws us. He wants us like Jesus. So he wants us to live in the life of his son.
And, we were just reading in our Lenten journey. We're ahead a little bit. So we were reading about Palm Sunday and just talking about how this was such a joyous time and everyone was celebrating that their king was here, their Messiah was here, he was coming, and they were celebrating, there was a parade. And then, of course, the bottom falls out. And then it gets even better. But that seems like that same shape of love that you're talking about. It's this journey of feeling like you're in one spot, then getting even lower, and then getting even higher.
Right, that's right. And it's helpful to see that for a bunch of reasons, because it allows me to endure down on the bottom. Because I know I'm not in control of the story. That's one of the things you learn very quickly in love, that anytime you set yourself to love, you're not in control of that. But that my Father's in control, and he's going to take me through a death and resurrection. I mean, the trick is I don't know the timing of the resurrection. I don't know the nature of the resurrection. That I don't control it. And what we would love to do is exit if we can't control the resurrection. That would be a very typical pattern. So the book of Ruth has that J curve to it. But the story of Joseph does, the story of Moses, David's life, Paul's life is a whole study. Paul the Apostle is a whole study of J curves. He's just going through them all the time. So it helps you know that there's a shape to the journey and where it's going, why is God's doing it, because he's during, especially at the bottom down there, when there doesn't seem to be any point of love anymore, because it feels like you're completely alone and that there's no exit out of this. That's where God is shaping us after the image of his son.
Mm. Well, and you use the book of Ruth, of course, throughout your book to talk about this journey of love, this J curve of love. How is the book of Ruth, this gospel story, a good news story?
Well, without retelling the whole story, let me just tell you a couple parts that I love about it that really bring this to life, I think. Is most Christians are aware of Ruth's incredible commitment to Naomi. She Naomi gives up her future for this woman who is not particularly pleasant, mm-hmm. All the time, which is her name means pleasant.
And, you know, it's an incredible statement of, you know, where you go, I will go. You know, your people will be my people. And I mean, it's just she's binding herself to this woman. And a lot of people will use it in their marriage vows. But then Ruth, but what we tend to miss is that immediately as Ruth does this, she starts going down a J curve, that she immediately begins to bear the cost of love, and her life constricts. And it happens immediately because Naomi doesn't even thank her. I mean, there's nothing, nada. You know, she's had this incredible pledge of love and marry, and Naomi doesn't say anything. You know, and at that point, what we're tempted to do is say, well, if you're not going to love me, then I'm not going to love you. And that's not Hesed love. That's not biblical love. Jesus says anybody can love that way. You know, he says that in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. He said, even the Gentiles, Jesus says, love them, you know, love one another when they get love in return. The question is, are you going to love when you stop getting love in return? And when you start doing that, it's almost like you're entering into the world of Christ. Mm-hmm. When your love is one way. And just a couple other examples, just continuing that story on from Ruth. Then when she goes into the city of Bethlehem, within a couple days, they make their way from Moab down the Jordan and up through the Judean wilderness and to Jerusalem and then down to Bethlehem, that when Naomi comes into the city, she doesn't even introduce Ruth. And that's why the women are all asking, is this Naomi? And when she rails out, you know, God has left me alone, you know, Ruth is, if I were in her shoes, I'd want to say, well, you know, what about me? You know, I mean, God hasn't left you alone, Naomi. So she's ignored. She's not introduced. The distance that Naomi is treating God with, she treats Ruth with. And then the next day, when Ruth gets up to go out in the field, there's no offer to help from Naomi. You know, she's not ancient. She could get out there and, you know, put in a couple hours. She doesn't give her any advice. And Ruth just cheerfully goes and does this one-way love where she's loving without love, you know, loving in return. And God having put me in situations like that for many years, and knowing that that in his own way, in his time, he does his resurrections, it's just fun. I can't read those passages without filling up again. It's just so, it's because that's where life is, I think, as its hardest. When you're loving and nothing is coming back at you. And in those situations, you begin to taste God. Mm-hmm. You get to know God. It strips you of your ego. It strips you of your will. And you get to know yourself. You get to know God. And out of that, the beauty of Jesus begins to emerge. And people begin to see Jesus in you.
Talking to author Paul Miller today about his book, A Loving Life, told through the book of Ruth. We'll chat more with Paul when we come back on Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Faith. Joy comes in the morning. We were just talking about how sometimes we feel like we're loving and getting nothing in return, and that may be the pattern, that may be the story of our journey with love, and helps direct us to who loves us more than anything, of course, and that's Christ. I'm talking with Paul Miller today about his book, A Loving Life in a World of Broken Relationships. Paul, you were just mentioning before the break that when we're down at the bottom of that J curve, when we feel like maybe no one is listening or hearing, that is when we truly are drawn to who Christ is and how much he loves us. Why is that? Why do we need to get to that point sometimes before we can finally get a taste of who he is?
Ego and will, or pride, and are just the human heart is so fiercely independent and so fiercely, fiercely self-exalting that it's down there in the weakness. And it's not just that we need to get rid of that stuff; is that it's just God shows up.
Mm-hmm.
It just that you meet God, and millions of people have testified, it's just true. It's just, and the longer you're down there, and you basically have two choices, either bitterness and cynicism or surrender. And in that surrender, you get to know God. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is I think it's Isaiah 58 that where God says, I live in the high exalted place and him with a humble and contrite heart. And it's just because God is so humble that's where we down in that place of brokenness is where we discover him.
I have to read this quote from your book about exactly this subject. You write, true authenticity is when I'm obeying in spite of my emotions. My feelings say drop out, but my commitment says hang in there. If I hang in there, eventually my feelings will right themselves and will catch up with my obedience.
Yeah, and out of it you come out with you just come out different when you hang in through suffering, and not just it really is critical to surrender and embrace this as a, and I'll use what Paul says in Philippians 3, as a fellowship of sharing in his sufferings, and that his being Jesus. Paul wants that, so there's an embracing of that. Here's just a quick story. My wife and I go to a camp every year. It's a Johnny camp. I don't know if you have them up in Minnesota, because we have a daughter with disabilities. And a few years ago at our camp, a woman, I'll call her Sue, was accused, and I think falsely, of saying something about another parent. And this woman, Sue, had paid like $600 of her own money to come to the camp and serve families with disabled kids. And on Tuesday of the camp, it just became a big drama thing. And I think the camp handled it well. I'm not critical of the camp at all. But now there's this sort of cloud over her. And I'm pretty sure she didn't do it, but because I've known her since then, it just doesn't make any sense. You get to know people's character. But here, so Wednesday morning she wakes up, and here she is. She's paid $600 to the week. She's serving all week, and it's just she's just absolutely distraught. And at that point, Sue feels like there was no point in doing this. Like, why did I ever even come? Here I'm trying to help, and all I get is trouble. And that's the bottom of the J-curve feeling. And I told Sue, I said, Sue, this is the point where you begin to love in new and deeper ways. I said, before this, you were in a kind of a transaction, because you were getting thanks and, camaraderie, being part of a serving team. You were getting something back. And now you're entering into the love of Calvary, because you're not getting anything back. And there's no human glory in this anymore. And as you go through that, Sue, that's where your ego and will are stripped, and that's your glory, is to endure in love when you're not getting anything back.
Mm. We have a caller calling in who has a question about this exact subject, Paula. I'm going to take this question,
okay.
And they want to know a little bit about broken relationships. You're an anonymous caller, so I'm not sure where you're calling from, but can you just feel free to ask Paul your question?
Yes, Paul, thank you for writing this book. I have a relationship on my husband's side, relationship, but I've had this relationship that just cannot, they just stiff arm you, and they're supposedly a Christian, and I am, and I just don't know how to handle this, but they just do not want a relationship with you at all, and I'm considered a loving person, and she's about the only person I have a problem with that I'm aware of. And I just, she, I just don't know how to. I just can't.
How long has it been going on?
About 38 years.
38 years.
And they just don't want to budge. And I've just been sweet and kind, and I just, I've given up.
Yeah. Since I suspect that someone that you have some opportunities for occasional regular contact, or it's enough of the significant of a relationship, I mean, here's just a couple suggestions, because you don't know. But anytime I get something like that, that becomes a daily prayer. And I use these little 3x5 cards that I use, and I would just write her name on it, and I would pray a scripture for that person. I had someone like that in my family. I actually wrote a chapter on a praying life, and that person had not liked me for, I think when I started praying about it, I think I was up to about 30 years. And I thought, you know, I really, they just regularly treated me badly. So I just began to pray daily for that person more thoughtfully. And I was just striking what God began to do almost immediately in that person's life. And the second thing is I almost delight at that kind of one-way love. Just even if it's only, say, 4 or 5 times a year at birthdays or Christmas, or just sending a note or a small gift, just keeping the door open a little bit. But a lot of times these are, we don't know what will happen, but a lot of times Paul's thorn in the flesh is his description of some of a J curve in his life that wouldn't go away. And the role of that J of that thorn in the flesh, and we have no idea what it was, and I'm actually kind of thankful we don't know, because that means you can put anything into it. And this is a thorn in the flesh, and by continuing to just have small acts of love, nothing big, and I wouldn't recommend any vigorous pursuit or anything. It is a little bit of a thorn in the flesh that is just it's a way of humbling us, that keeps us needy in a very small way, and that Paul says then about that thorn in the flesh, I needed that to keep me from becoming conceited, and I don't necessarily sense that in you, but all of us. Those thorns draw us in even small ways into Christ. So that's just a couple thoughts.
I hope that helped very much. We'll make sure Carissa gets you a copy of Paul's book as well and get that sent out to you. And again, the praying life, I do remember that chapter. And because everyone seems to have someone in their family where they're struggling with a relationship with. So I hope you'll get a copy of that as well. Thanks so much for calling. Paul, you know, one of the things you mention, I mean, it's throughout your book and, of course, in the story of Ruth as well, that in love, that self really has to die, and that through that death, that's when God really begins to speak into our lives so that we can understand. Talk more about that, because that is really had an impact on me.
Oh, my. I mean, the death of self is not very pretty. I would actually ask you, Joe, how that's had an impact on you, because I could talk on and on.
Oh, my goodness. Because if I am struggling with relationship with someone and I put their name on a card, I still find myself praying, I need this, I need this. Can you help them do this? Because I need this. And it's all about me, me, me. And it's until I get to that point where I forget what I need and start praying in earnest for that person and for God to speak into their lives, that's when he begins to speak into mine.
Yes, that's great. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. You know, the one thing that reminds me of, Joe, what you said, is that one of the most beautiful things in the book of Ruth is that after chapter 3, she disappears. She doesn't say anything more. We do see her at the very end of the book mentioned, but she goes silent. She's silent. There's no Ruth in the beginning, the first 6 or 7 verses, and then the last chapter she disappears. she is celebrated at the end, which is really sweet. But she and there's this sense in love that you disappear. And what we recoil from naturally is we recoil from in love, where it's one-way love. We recoil from the fact that we're disappearing in that relationship. But it is very much the nature of love to disappear. And I just, it's one of those things, it's one of those things on the feel of love that if you know that, you really can become content with it and actually begin to see the joy in it.
Mm. We're talking with author Paul Miller today. He's written a wonderful book called A Loving Life in a World of Broken Relationships. We're going to chat more with Paul when we come back. I think we still have one more copy of his book. If you'd like that to get that in your hands, you can give us a call at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. We'll be right back after the break on Connecting Faith. Talking about love today on Connecting Faith with author Paul Miller, who's written a book called A Loving Life. He also wrote a book called A Praying Life, which I would highly recommend. Teaches us how to connect with God through prayer. Paul, we were just talking about that love and the experience of love, this hesed love that we strive for, can often help us to know God so much better, that it's in those difficult times of relationships and broken relationships that we probably get to know him best. Although we'd never wish that on our worst enemy, right?
Right, that's right, yep. Yep, that's very true.
And yet when you see someone come through that with a greater understanding, not only of themselves, but who God is, then all of a sudden it's worth that journey that you had to go on. Are you finding that with the people who you spoke with in writing this book?
Yeah, I mean, it's just true everywhere that, because, Calvin begins his Institutes with a fairly well-known reflection that the knowledge of yourself and the knowledge of God mirror one another. So, and that you can actually begin with either, and you'll that if you have a true knowledge of God, you arrive at a true knowledge of yourself, and if you have a true knowledge of yourself, you'll arrive at a true knowledge of God. And we tend not to know ourselves well, and that's why often people struggle in marriage, because they actually can get to know the other person's sins pretty well, but we all struggle getting to know ourselves, because it's just, we aren't always our best critics, or we're overly critical, or, we kind of go all over the map. So one of the neat things about about love, where you encounter God, you also encounter yourself. And here's my little quick summary of that. I know I'm going in a slightly different direction, is that the modern self I would call the fractured self. And it's fractured at so many levels. It's like if you posture, and try to pretend you're more incompetent than you are or something, or you boast about something, you've created two selves. So there's the boasting self, and then there's the real you. So a husband who watches porn at night and then greets his wife warmly has created two selves. And so the modern feel is the fractured self. And then what happens as you really begin to enter life of love and you become self-forgetting, you become, my little phrase for it is the multiplied self, because then you're not, as Princeton scholar B.B. Warfield said, is you're not living one life anymore, but you're living 1,000 lives. Mm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a very difficult journey to have to be on.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. The fractured self will drive you nuts. I mean, just think of the rise of anxiety in our modern culture. I mean, I, I, was with a drug rep on a sat next to her on a plane, a woman, and she told me that she thought 2/3 of American middle class and upper middle class women were on some form of drugs, you know, for the anxious self. And you know, what the fractured self is very anxious. You know, it's constantly trying to pull all these pieces together, as opposed to a life of love that is just a lot of fun.
Well, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, that it seems like today the message for our culture is that happiness is the goal. If we're not happy or feel happy,
right,
then we are encouraged to move on and to get out, to leave,
yes,
a church, leave a job, leave a spouse.
Right.
But this concept of love is very different, and the reward is so great if we can get through it.
Yeah, and what you do is you constantly experience these resurrections. Let me do a commercial on resurrection for a minute. and the very first resurrection that you experience when you receive this as a fellowship of his suffering is in your own heart. Because then jobs become joyous, because when there is nothing more burdensome than chasing happiness. Hmm. If you have any questions about that, then interview parents on their exiting Disney after 4 days with four kids, or three kids, or, thinking, why did I pay for this? This is our family. My daughter Kim, who's disabled, loves going to Disney, but she's one of the few people who isn't that way. But the pursuit of happiness as an end in of itself is one of the saddest journeys there is. As the pursuit of Christ and love and people, it just leads to both sadness and joy. And there's no non-sad exit out of this world, so you might as well involve Jesus in it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember, I've told this story on the air before, but I remember as a newly married person, when my husband and I had our first disagreement, and I remember thinking, I'm out of here, meaning I was just going to leave the house and be gone. And so I took a little walk, and as I'm on my walk, I kept thinking, I have to go back. I mean, normally, if that were a boyfriend or something, I'd be out of there. It was a pattern in my life. Oh, someone doesn't agree with me. Well, I guess I'm out of here. And,
right.
And then I experienced exactly what you just said is, wait a minute. Now I have a commitment to be connected with this person and to work through,
yes,
it with this person.
Yeah.
And instead of feeling like I was trapped, it was actually finally a way where I said, oh, I'm not supposed to do that with relationships. I see a relationship means that I actually go back and have a,
yeah,
conversation and work through it. But that,
yeah,
was a very real,
yes,
realization for me, something that I hadn't put in that context before,
yes,
that.
Yes, I would actually say most of modern America is walking out when things get hard, and they don't have any grid for the hard work of enduring in love, and so people end up just going from, you know, either relationship to relationship, and the result is a tremendous amount of loneliness in our culture. Mm. With that, so that's a great story. And then for many, I'm sure listeners even now, is how do you go back when you're not going to be listened to?
Mm.
And I'm not saying that you stay in an abusive relationship. If your spouse hits you, call the police. I'm not saying that at all. But most problems in marriage are not at that level. A lot of them are just, you know, living with another sinner.
Mm.
And how do you endure when I'm a sinner and with this other person who's treating me at times badly? And that's where, just like you said, Joe, we often come alive, mm, as we love. Hey, Joe, can I throw out one more thing?
Sure.
That it's a little bit related to what you said, is that kind of the connection between love and community is that a lot of people are on this hunt for community or intimacy. Or another way of saying that, and just think of the story you just told, is we're hunting for a relationship where we can feel good. And that quest is a, I'll use a, you know, big fancy word, but it's idolatrous. because it's putting love as the quest itself. And it's an impossible quest. You will never find community and intimacy. You'll end up alone. And let me just give a quick example of what this looks like for any of us. And that, like, if you come into a room of strangers, our first thought is, who do I know here? Or let's say it's an office party or something like that, or something at church. And our first question tends to be, who do I know? How can I be included? Does anybody like me here? And we don't even ask those questions. They're just there. They're shaping how we come into the room. And now none of those questions are wrong, but the dominance of them tends to skew us. And I would call it the Jesus question is, who's alone? Who's left out? Can I help them be included? And what that does then is that then I am going to the outsider and I'm creating community through love. So love then, where I go through these little deaths, ends up creating community, as opposed to what people are trying to do is pursuing community directly. Does that make sense?
Oh, that is brilliant. I mean, I'm thinking that applies to the child in middle school, all the way up to, we moved to a community where most people were born and bred in that community. And of course, they already had their connections. And I just keep thinking about that first year we were there and how difficult that was. And I'm so grateful that someone pursued me to be their friend. And then I became part of that community, as opposed to me thinking, who can I pursue in order to become part of that community? I mean, that is just brilliant. And people probably go through that with a new job, moving to a new space, being a new parent or moving to a new church. And that's just a great tip for all of us to be the person who's offering love instead of looking for love in a community.
And that what that does is that it frees you from hunting for the kind of perfectionism is just on such the rise in our culture. And so people are hunting for the perfect community, let's just say a good church or something. But what that means is that no matter, and again, you're not married to your church, so it's not like you have to stay in a particular church. But as long as you're there, is that you can, every Christian can be a community creator. And I think one of our calling in a postmodern, post-Christian world is to outdo political correctness. And that we as Christians can really create the true inclusive community so that we're constantly bringing in the outsider, that we're constantly on the margins and hunting for people who are on the margins.
That is just a very sweet way to come to an end to our program, Paul. In fact, we have just a couple of minutes left. Would you just pray for that listener who's listening today thinking, you know, I need to mend a broken relationship and I'm not quite sure how to do that? If you could just pray for them and we will end the program with that. How does that sound?
Sure. Father, I pray for anyone who's listening now, who's in either a broken or a difficult relationship where it feels like they've disappeared, where they feel like they've lost their voice. I pray, Father, that you would give them the grace to endure in that relationship. And, Father, they can only do that by the power of your Spirit. This is not human effort. It's only something that the enduring, patient Spirit of Jesus can do in and through us. And I pray, Father, that in that enduring, in that embrace, I pray you give them the grace to accept a fellowship of sharing in his sufferings. And Father, as they're living through this J curve, I pray that you would meet them and that you would meet them with the promise of your word and you would encourage them in this good work. And I pray that in your time that you would give them a resurrection. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that prayer, Paul. And just for the last hour, you've given us so much to think about and for writing this book, A Loving Life. So grateful for you.
Thank you, Joe. It's great being with you.
Thank you. And if you missed part of our interview and you'd like to hear the rest of the show, you can head back to our website at myfate.com. faithradio.com. Click on the Connecting Faith show page, and you can listen to a podcast of this program. It will be up in just a few minutes, or of any other program we have here on Faith 900. Thanks for joining us.